the Observations Podcast. Hold on. I've done the wrong thing. This is the Observations Podcast. Notice how the music is supposed to get quieter when I talk, not the microphone. Anyway, welcome back to the podcast. I'm Dale Franks. Michael Wade is with us, having camera trouble. He will join us here in a little bit. We can see the screen there. He's with us. And by the way, he can talk. Hello, Michael. I can hear you.
Hey, I'm here.
So we are here and ready to discuss the week. I did write a couple of articles this week that maybe we want to touch on. I'm not entirely sure, but at least I have them up and ready to go. But I did want to talk about one thing, which is something that went on this week at MIT. And what happened was, you know, we've been having all of these pro-Hamas protests, or, well, pro-Palestinian protests is what they're calling them. And they had an unauthorized protest. And technically, what's supposed to happen if you participate in an unauthorized protest and the police have to be called to clear you out, you get expelled from MIT. Those are the rules. MIT decided not to expel the participants because to do so would, if they were suspended, then it would invalidate their student visas and they would be deported. And so therefore, Sally Kornbluth, the MIT president, basically let out a statement that said, yeah, we didn't suspend any of the students who were participating because we were afraid they would be deported. Why shouldn't they be deported?
That's a good question. Why are they here? They don't seem to like it here.
Yeah, and that is really what, that's really one of the things that gets me about how this is being, how this whole pro-Palestinian thing is being pushed in American universities. It's very, very troubling, especially when there are American students involved, and we'll have to talk about what we do about that a little later, but as far as foreign students go, why not deport them? I mean, they clearly hate the country. They're here to get a benefit from us. Don't we have the right to say, hey, you know, we don't feel that we receive a benefit from you being educated here. Maybe you should go back to your own country and go to school.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, especially when they agitate like they do and talk about, all they do is come here and try to disrupt what we have going on. Well, I mean, if you didn't like it, then why did you come here? You know, there's no requirement that you come here, benefit greatly from all the advantages that you have living in an advanced capitalist society, and then complain about it and try to undermine it. I mean, we don't need to deal with you. You're not even a citizen.
Yeah, that's the, you know, I didn't want to get into it yet, but that's the whole problem, is that we just seem unable or unwilling, for whatever reason, to just take a look at immigrants and say, look, there's a couple of things that you just don't get if you come to America. First of all, you don't get free stuff. You don't get FDC. You don't participate in the Social Security program. You don't get Medicaid. You get no social support whatsoever. It should, in fact, be illegal for anyone to get any sort of public money. You know, it goes back to Milton Friedman, you know, who famously said, although he was much more nuanced than we generally give it credit for, he mainly said, you know, you can't have a welfare society and free immigration. You can have free immigration to come here for jobs, but you can't have free immigration to come here for and just pick up welfare. We won't do that. we have, and by the way, it's even worse in a country like England, as we've seen. You know, as bad as it's been in the United States and places like New York and in Washington, D.C. and out here in Los Angeles, look at what's been going on in London. Where people are just, you know, and the British have a little different view of freedom of speech than we do. Since 1997, in the United States, Hamas has been a terrorist organization. The Clinton administration listed Hamas as a terrorist organization. They have been now for, you know, 25 years at this point, 26. England, they are a proscribed terrorist organization, which means it is illegal to publicly express support for Hamas in England. But it does seem to be, over the last couple of weeks, a law that is much more honored in the breach than the observance.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So, the whole thing is, you know, it really is the culture. We have built a culture that, at least in academia, and is kind of filtered out everywhere else into every institution, this modern neo-Marxist oppressor-oppressed paradigm. This oppressor-oppressed paradigm is, I believe, what Marxists in this country have decided to substitute for the class struggle.
Absolutely.
And it works way better than the class struggle, because this isn't, you know, 1848, right? Which is when Marx published the Communist Manifesto. The situations, even in Western countries who, you know, were formerly aristocratically based. Well, I mean, that hasn't been true largely in Europe since 1918. I mean, there's no Kaiser. There's no French king. There's no real aristocracy in those countries. There hasn't been for like 100 years. Spain went under a fascist government from the 1930s to the 1970s, when they reinstituted sort of a constitutional monarchy. But the president, or the king of Spain, doesn't really have a whole lot of power. It's a constitutional monarchy. The structure of all of these governments have changed post 1918. And the idea of the class struggle has become less and less relevant in the West as the years have gone on, right? So how do you replace class? Replace it with the oppressed-oppressor paradigm. Because now it doesn't matter what social class you come from or what your income class is, just by virtue of certain immutable characteristics, you get to be either oppressed or oppressors. And it's marvelously flexible, and it's an infection, and I don't know how to drive that infection out.
Well, we only know of one certain way, and that's a really bloody revolution. But just in terms of culturally, how do you retard that, and how do you turn that around? Yeah, that's a really difficult question, because in the end, unless you can't really force people to believe something or accept something that they just won't do. You know, it takes a long time to change those cultural norms, especially when they're being pushed from the top down. You know, probably some of the best things you could do is kill social media altogether.
Well, you know, there is one way that you could fix it, right? And that would be to, I mean, the way that we got here was via, and look, people on the left say there was no long march through the institutions. That's a conservative boogeyman. So there was no progressive conspiracy to take over all the institutions. And you know what? Maybe they're right. Maybe it wasn't a progressive conspiracy. Maybe they didn't use it was Antonio Gramsci, the Italian socialist, came up with the idea of war on position. What we call the Long March Through the Institutions came from a German socialist activist named Rudi Dutschke, who called it the Long War or the Long March Through the Institutions. And it was basically Gramsci sort of regurgitated. Although, interestingly, doesn't appear that he ever heard of Antonio Gramsci. But the idea behind that was, of course, to have this, you know, this infiltration of the institutions and take them over from the inside. But at this point, it doesn't matter whether that was an intentional conspiracy that they managed to pull off. It happened anyway. And the only way to reverse it is for people who, what I guess we would broadly in American terms call the right, would be to create their own institutions, to re-infiltrate the existing institutions, work from inside, and slowly change them. But that's the work of, you know, a couple of generations. I don't know that we have the time to do that.
No. And, well, we need to start anyway, because otherwise it's always going to be too late. But it's certainly not something you can turn around in a matter of even a decade. I mean, it was a long march through the institutions. And Gramsci absolutely talked about that. He and his buddies, the Frankfurt School, this was not hidden. You know, it's not in the fever dreams of the swamps of the GOP.
Oh, no, look.
This was actively...
Go ahead. No, I was just about to say,
well,
yeah.
I mean,
Gramsci wrote about it. I mean, he wrote an entire book about the war of position and how effective it would be. What he called the Russian Revolution was a war of movement. What he called what he wanted to do, the war of position. Rudi Dutschke apparently came up with it, you know, sort of de novo on his own and called it the Long March Through the Institution. But it was basically Gramsci's war on position. Dutschke's name stuck, but it's still the Gramscian idea, or Gramscian idea. But it doesn't matter how we got here. The fact is we're here, and I don't know how to reverse it. I mean, I know how. One way of reversing it is just to retake the institutions. But do we have the time to do that? Do we have 20 or 30 years to turn back to a more traditional America? I'm pretty sure that we don't.
Yeah, I think the best we can do at this point, really, is creating alternative institutions. Now, one thing is helping, because remember, nothing happens in a vacuum. And it's helping that the normal avenues of cultural output that the left uses, movies, radio, TV, literature, that these are failing miserably with the public, you know? And
The Marvels over the weekend made like 27 million.
Yeah.
It's the worst ever for any Marvel movie.
I mean, that's like a month's worth of filming. I mean, that's like, it's not even close to coming to break even. Yeah, and so these things are failing. You're seeing Disney fail. Movies and Hollywood in general are becoming less and less relevant. The TV shows that used to be on the prime channels that we used to all watch, The Cosby Show, Happy Days, you know, Battlestar Galactica, whatever it was, you know, everybody watched Seinfeld in the 90s was a big one, and like Friends or whatever. I mean, this was, you know, the talk around the water cooler, right? We don't have that anymore. You know, unless you're up on the latest Netflix, binging craze, or, you know, what's going on Paramount Plus, you really don't, you don't know what everybody else is watching and thinking about. And we don't have that commonality anymore. And so we've become a lot more fragmented. And Hollywood isn't, they still keep trying to put out these movies as if this very distorted worldview that they court is somehow normal, and it's just not. People are into it. You know, they may not be politically enraged, or they just don't care for it. It's not something that they enjoy. And it's interesting that you brought up 1848, because that was a common complaint amongst the tried and true communist revolutionaries, who are like, what is it with these people? They're more interested in being you know, Czechoslovakians and or Austrians than they are in being socialists. And that really bothered them because they couldn't figure out what they were missing. And I think we're kind of in a similar place here. So like I said, the closest thing that we can do is start standing up our own sources of entertainment and media. And that's been happening for the last 20 years, albeit
on a very small scale.
Yeah. But it's starting to creep in because the left is just, they're going so overboard so quickly. I mean, this transgender craze was like nothing. And then all of a sudden, in a hot minute, we're all supposed to use different pronouns. And don't dead name people. It's like, what are you talking about? I mean, people are really upset and frustrated with this stuff.
Yeah, and you look, it's indicative, especially when you get to things like the pronouns, right? It's indicative of a divorce from reality.
Yeah.
We have pronouns so that we can easily refer to someone in the third person without having to mention their name all the time. And so it makes life a lot easier for us without having to, you know, remember a whole bunch of names. We can just say he, she, it, them, and you know, that kind of covers everybody. If we're going to get into a situation where everybody gets to choose different pronouns, one of the funniest examples I heard, and I forget where it comes from, but I identify as the Great Northern Railroad. My pronouns are Chug and Chew. Okay, great. But now that means I have to remember an entirely different set of pronouns for each individual. That eliminates the whole purpose of pronouns. It's easier just to refer to you by name at that point and never use pronouns at all. It's just divorced from how the reality of how language works and what it's supposed to do.
And right.
There's a lot of that divorce from reality when you start looking into these things. You know, and the thing that irks me more than anything else when we talk about that divorce from reality is you have biologists who are coming out now saying, well, you know, there's no such thing as a gender binary in science.
Yeah, right.
Bullshit.
Until approximately 5 minutes ago, that was solid state science. Like, there wasn't even a question about it.
You know, the way that archaeologists have worked for many, many years now when digging up the bones of ancient civilizations and looking at skeletons is being able to say, oh, that was a female. We can tell simply because of the skeletal structure in the pelvic area. We can tell that was a female.
That's exactly right.
And now we're seeing, and I actually saw this like 3 or 4 weeks ago, a paper that they could not find, and it was almost hilarious to read, and now that I've thought about it, I wish I could go back and find it. The links that they went through to explain that this skeleton had this sort of pelvic girdle, but we don't know whether they identified as a man or a woman.
Right.
I think if you're finding 1,000-year-old skeletons, there's an excellent possibility that they identified as a woman.
There's even a bigger possibility that I don't care. I don't really care what the hell they identified it. It's got nothing to do with anything. Who were they? What did they do? Why should I care about them in the first place, other than the fact that their old remains may give us clues about, you know, what they ate, how they lived, how he or she died, or it, or whatever.
Their burial rituals, all that sort of stuff.
But I mean, how he or she or it identified is, it really doesn't add to the story unless that was a major part of their story. And it's very, very doubtful that it ever was.
But again, it's this divorce from reality. We can't call things what they are. You know,
Well, that's because you're working on the assumption that many on the left do not, that there is a capital T truth, a capital R reality that is immutable and does not depend on the observer. Well, many on the left don't think in those terms. Reality is whatever we say it is, whatever the most people say it is. You know, reality is perception. You know, there is no capital T truth.
Yeah, but you know, there is my truth. And my truth is, as soon as I hear my truth, I just immediately drown out, and all I can catch after that is blah, 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 blah. It's what was it, the Peanuts TV show.
Yeah.
Wah, 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 wah. That's
there
all
was
I
a
hear.
Great scene in what was that movie? Not something couples retreat with what's his face, Vince Vaughn, and the woman who was playing his wife, Romaine or whatever her name is,
Rebecca Romaine.
Anyways, I think is that I don't know. I don't think it was her, but whoever it is, it doesn't really matter. The point is that he's swimming in these little baby lemon sharks, like nip him. And it's like, he's like, I'm the only one here that survived a shark attack.
Oh, yeah.
And he's, yeah. And he's in session with what's that guy's name? John Michael Higgins, who is awesome in all those movies. And he's just like, did I hear you just say, you know, your reality? I know my reality. He's like, oh boy.
Yeah, but that's,
it's all excited.
But that's the normal lingua franca. In the progressive worldview.
And it's just assumed that this should be the normal way of thinking without any effort to convince anybody that this new way of, well, it's actually an old way of thinking, should be, I guess, paramount to what has been built up over literally centuries of philosophical and scientific and mathematical thought. To the idea that, well, look, yeah, I know there's the whole thing about, does perception change reality? Okay, that's a really interesting philosophical question. But in the end, it came down to, well, there is this thing that happens, and we're simply figuring out a language to describe it. Some people think math is the best language. Some people think physics. But whatever it is, we're simply trying to describe reality. We're not creating reality. We're not changing. It's not subject to our whims. You know, as Rudyard Kipling wrote, you know, the gods of the copybook headings will prevail.
Yeah, no matter how much you might think you can fly, jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge will very quickly disprove that, no matter what
you're
think
flying.
The reality is. Oh, yeah, you're flying in a single predictable direction.
But you only get one.
Yeah, you get one good flight, so make it a good one. I suppose part of the problem is that education was the institution that went first.
Yes, absolutely.
And once you, and see, you don't even really, and this is why I think I can give some credence to people on the left who say, well, this whole long march to the institutions, it never really happened. There was never a plan to do that. I don't think you need a plan once you control education. Once you control the teacher schools, you can indoctrinate the teachers. And once they get out into the real world, they will in turn begin indoctrinating their students. And when their students get out into the real world, many of whom, especially those who stay in higher education for advanced degrees, will end up going into academia. And then others will go into the nonprofits or into library science. And so just by controlling education, you don't have to control every institution. You don't have to invade and infiltrate every institution. If you take control of education,
not directly,
if you take control of education, it'll take 30
right.
or 40
years. You're worming your way in there, whether they like it or not.
Yeah, because everybody who graduates from a major university, and just look at the ridiculousness going on at our premier universities, Harvard and Yale, and the outlandish things that they believe. And all these kids that believe these outlandish things.
I think the people that go
things,
there now are well, they're dumber than a box of rocks. I mean, I have no confidence whatsoever that any of these people there have any merit at all, intellectually or otherwise. they may be able to sound intellectually correct because they can string together all the correct terms of the narrative. And so in that sense, I suppose they're at least somewhat intelligent, but they don't seem to have any reasoning capabilities whatsoever. And while I don't think that reasoning is entirely innate, some people are maybe more amenable to it than others. It's certainly something you can learn and learn to sharpen, absolutely. And I think the best thinkers are those ones who have learned to sharpen those reasoning skills and to do so dispassionately.
Yeah, well, and that's what college is supposed to teach.
Right. And it's the exact opposite now. They're being turned into little Maoist soldiers, essentially. I mean, that's what the Little Red Book was all about, was so that you'd have your constant talking points with you and always know how to denounce properly and advance the revolution.
You know,
and that was paramount. That was the most important thing.
I used to tell my undergraduate students repeatedly when they would basically ask me for an answer whenever we were talking about, ethical questions or things like that. And I'd always tell them, my job is not to tell you what to think. My job is to teach you how to think. And that doesn't seem to be the prevailing ethos, certainly not in our major universities. It's now been, we're here to tell you how to think. And by the way, if you don't
In law school, I was going to say, even in law school, where the Socratic method really does still, prevail, the method of asking questions to elicit ideas and answers. But even in these law schools, it's suggested pretty heavily that there's really only one right answer. And even worse, that there's only one correct framework, which can only yield a specific answer. So you start controlling people's frameworks. Well,
you control their reasoning.
Of course, you're going to get the answers you want.
Yeah, right. Control the framework, you control the reasoning. And that is why this oppressor dynamic is so dangerous.
Pernicious.
It's very absolutely pernicious. And what it gets you into is a oppression Olympics where everybody has to find the event that gives them a spot at the starting line for oppression.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a class race based on other classifications. You know, now it's just a victim class, and then the different hierarchies within that. I mean, there's a totem pole in the whole victim class thing.
Well, here's the thing. There's not supposed to be.
Right.
There isn't supposed to be. What they say
nominally,
what they say publicly, and by the way, let's just take a look at something here that might be interesting. This is the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of African American History and Culture. This is their website. And they talk about whiteness and what whiteness is and how every white person has been privileged to be white. However, there is a path to salvation. White people can possess other marginalized parts of their identity. Well, I want to know about that. So
right.
Then we get into systems of oppression. And they're very, very sure to tell you. Let's see if I can find the exact passage. Yeah, here we go. There is no hierarchy of oppressions. Oppression causes deep suffering, but trying to decide whether one oppression is worse than others is problematic. Okay, sure, that's the party line, but the reality is what you end up seeing are things like at the Black Lives Matter movement, right? When they had the marches where only black people were allowed to speak. For right. Everyone else, no, you can't talk. This is our time for listening. So yep. When it becomes useful, a hierarchy of oppression gets implemented toot sweet.
Oh, yeah. And you see this in the struggle sessions. you know, when Brett Weinstein was eventually drummed out of Evergreen, you know, the whole reason he caused so much consternation was because he showed up on a day that only black people were allowed to be on campus, and or people of color, being
people of
a
color.
White and possibly Jewish person was, no matter how progressive, and Brett Weinstein is admittedly pretty progressive. Didn't matter. Ideology didn't matter. All that mattered was the color of your skin and your sexual orientation. Well, and probably your sexual thingies too. Those matter as well.
Well, not as much as it might have in the past. Because now that's irrelevant, because your gender is all, of course, a social construct.
Well, so, only in the right, only when they deem it so. Like that, at that, I can't remember. I think we talked about it briefly about the that women's conference or whatever it was for IT workers, and a bunch of guys showed up and said that they were non-binary, and they were not well treated. There was a lot of suspicion that maybe they were trying to pull the wool over the old transgender's eyes. So, you know, there are times when, you know, your bona fides of belonging to that oppressor class makes a difference.
Yeah, I'm listening to you. I was actually wanting to look at something in the systems of oppression thing, because, you know, we talked about my truth, and someone in chat, Jim McGinnis, quoted my lived experience.
Oh, yeah, that's another one. And they can't decide on how to say that word. Is it lived or lived? It should be lived, but they're idiots.
And I just wanted to point out, yeah, of course, here we go. Oppression causes deep suffering, but trying to decide whether one oppression is worse than others are problematic. It diminishes lived experiences and divides communities that should be working together. Many people experience abuse across based on multiple social identities. So there is a path to salvation, and that path to salvation is, of course, becoming oppressed in some way.
Exactly. Yeah. So I identify as a two left-footed, one-armed refugee from Armenia. Oh, no, that's not good. Sudan.
And by the way, when it comes time to be listened to, like in the Black Lives Matter protest, when we could only listen to what black people had to say because white people could not possibly have anything to offer to that conversation, because obviously their lived experience was different. Who ranks higher on the oppression scale in that environment? Is it the black conservative lesbian woman? Who is, after all, black, and who is lesbian.
Right. And a woman.
And a woman, but she's a conservative.
Yeah, just missed it.
So does she beat the white gay male?
I don't think she even beats the white straight male who is fully allied with the progressive cause. So even like a, I don't know, maybe a Chris Cuomo, or he's kind of a, maybe a weird example, but, or maybe a Jake Tapper,
look, the thing
somebody
is,
like that.
The thing is, it's genius.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it really is. It is so delightfully flexible when it comes to being able to assign people an oppression grade based on some immutable characteristics. And yet it is also rigidly inflexible when it comes to political
and everybody knows the
ideology.
Rules. There's no guessing at what the rules are here. We know the rules. Everybody knows the rules. And that's what's, oh, there are no rules for who's more oppressed than the others. Well, we all know that's bullshit. We all know exactly who's more in the hierarchy, who has more power than others. It's blatantly obvious, and it's on display almost every single day. We know the rules. They don't have to explain them to us. It's just they don't want to admit what the actual rules are, because they're racist, they are bigoted, And they are essentially exactly what the left rails against, even though all of this stuff generally arises from the left. They just don't want to take ownership of it.
And, you know, you would think, especially after over the last month, that of all the people who might have a claim to being oppressed, it would be Jews.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, from since Roman times, since 70 AD, it's basically been a history of persecutions, pogroms,
back to the Exodus.
Yeah, discrimination. But they don't count. And they don't count now because Israel exists.
Right.
And so Israel now becomes the oppressor. And by extension, you know, all Jews now become the oppressor. And so they
It's funny how anybody who is not in the favored classes is susceptible to guilt for all his or her class members for anything they do. But, you know, when Hamas goes and tortures, kills, rapes, and mutilates a bunch of people, a bunch of civilians, well, look, they don't stand for all the Hamas people or even all the Palestinian people. We need to divide this down. Oh, really?
Yeah, you're a representative of your class right up until the point it becomes inconvenient. And here's the other thing that really has irked me over the last couple of weeks. There's all this talk about, well, Israel needs to have a ceasefire. They need to ensure that their response is proportional. They need to be sure, you know, people are upset, but it's only because of, you know, Arabs are dying and Muslims are dying. And so they care so, so very much about their fellow Muslims. Really? Mm-hmm. Do they care about the half million or so of their fellow Muslims that Bashar al-Assad has killed over the past
brutally
decade?
Brutally murdered with sarin gas.
Do they care much?
Many of them children.
Yeah, do they care much about the 200,000 Muslims that have been killed in Yemen?
Yeah.
No, not so much, apparently.
Or Somalia, or Iran in general, Afghanistan in general? No, they don't care about that. That's Muslims doing to other when the oppressed class argues amongst themselves, that's just, oh, that's a horrible misunderstanding.
Yeah.
But when somebody with power who is identified with the oppressor class steps in and says, hey, you can't just come into my house and rape my family, burn my babies, or else I'm going to come back after you. Oh, no, you can't come back after me unless you do it proportionally. And all I've got left is a little pea shooter. Well, too bad. Shouldn't have broke into my house.
Yeah, so you get this, you don't even get ideological consistency. So again, if you're white, especially if you're a white heterosexual male, it's very difficult to get out of the oppressor class. After all, you've benefited from whiteness, and whiteness is a system of oppression. I mean, the Smithsonian Institution, funded by our tax dollars, tells us so. And by the way, you want to talk about institutional capture? We've just seen from the Smithsonian a pretty good example of that.
Yes.
Ideological capture. So if you're a white heterosexual male, you are just by default part of the oppressor class. And
because of your identity and nothing else. Actions don't matter.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
which
your actions,
the antithesis your of actions, Western ideology.
Your actions can matter as long as you abjectly bow.
To a point, comrade.
Yeah, as long as you abjectly bow to the ideology and you obey,
right,
and you abase yourself properly, you can be tolerated. If you don't, then there is no toleration for you because, hey, you're an oppressor. So, okay, now I've got, you know, collective guilt, collective responsibility that gets imposed on me. And by the way, something else that really got me about the Smithsonian thing, which again, I'll share again, will control F. Color, do they have it as one word, color blindness or color blind? It's not on this page. It's on one of these two pages. So I just got to switch to the correct page. So I think it may be on Systems of Oppression. And that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to hit Control F and look at this. Oh gosh darn it, I can't find it. They have this whole section on color blindness that I came across, and how, you know, color blindness was basically, let's try it again, F. I'm hitting Alt instead of Control. Blind, not with a V, with a B, B-L-I-N-D. Okay, it's not on this page. I can't find it. But basically, it's on one of these pages at this. Wait a second. I know I can find it because I have the link. So let me look for something here. Here we go. It wasn't at, sorry, it wasn't at the Smithsonian. It's at Fitchburg State University.
Oh, the renowned Fitchburg State?
Yeah, the renowned Fitchburg State. Why
is
color?
Is that the Fitchburg campus or the other one?
I'm going to assume it's the Fitchburg campus. But why color blindness acts to perpetuate racism? So color blindness is bad, which I guess means that Dr. King's dream of his children being judged by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin was in itself racist, no doubt, because Dr. King had internalized whiteness.
Well, I mean, he had adopted the Christian religion, so that was probably a bad idea. But it's funny that there is, I think, an argument to be made that color blindness has some rippling problems, potential problems. I don't think it's the cause and basis of everything. I saw a TED talk with this this one guy. He's a black guy, grandfather. He's got a white granddaughter or whatever, and grandkids and whatever. And so, you know, he's like, yeah, we're pretty colorblind. We don't really see it. But at the same time, you need to know that somebody else probably went through something different than you. And the color of their skin does make a difference. Okay. I think that's a good argument as far as it goes. What the left has done is not turn that into a thought or taken that from a thought experiment and turned it into a cudgel that, oh, you're colorblind. That means you're just not willing to worship at the feet of the black man. It's like, what? Like, where do we get the whole point to colorblindness when, you know, when you and I grew up, it was like, and that was when the whole thing about phobias started too, right? You're you're ignorant of them because, and you're scared of them because you're ignorant. You're prejudiced because you just don't know anything about them. Get to know people. Stop seeing them as a black person. See them as your schoolmate, as your basketball team player, your soccer team player, whatever, teammate. You know, look past that. And so that's kind of how we grew up. I mean, at least I did. And the fact that somebody was black or Asian or whatever, like, just it sort of washes over me. It doesn't register anything other than, hey, you're different than I am. Okay. Guess what? So is everybody else in some way or another. I don't care if they look like me or not. But now it's been turned into, oh, you're colorblind because you don't want to see the atrocities and oppression that your race causes these oppressed peoples. It's like, what? First of all, you never have presented me with that case that just being white actually oppresses people. And in the times you have done it, it's been presented so ipsy-dixit, so, you know, speaking from up on high, that there is no questioning or delineating allowed. We just have to accept it as you said it, and that's it, based on no authority. It's like you're speaking a priori. Well, I don't know anybody that does that. I mean, God, I suppose.
And the other insidious thing is the way that it defines oppression down.
Yes, absolutely. Well, just like they're defining genocide down.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you talk about oppression, if you just look at the dictionary definition of oppression, it is prolonged repression, basically. It is brutal and it is unfair. It is life-threatening, but that's not the way that they use it. What they call oppression is that people are made to feel uncomfortable.
Well, right? That's right. I mean, that's the limit. As soon as you feel uncomfortable,
you're being oppressed.
Oh, I'm being oppressed. Come and see the violence inherent in the system. Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's oftentimes a reaction to simply your identity. And maybe your identity is as an American. So I've got a flag on my front porch. Well, you're oppressing people. I'm oppressing people by living in America and having an American flag on my porch? Yeah, that says something very different to other people. Like, well, why is that my problem? This wasn't intended to send some complicated message. It was, hey, I'm proud of my country. I love my country. Yeah, well, your country sucks. Well, then get the fuck out. We're right back to the square one.
Yeah, we're right back to, you know, what responsibility do we have to, I don't even want to say responsibility. How do you go about fixing something like that? I mean, it seems to me that if you can't do it through culture because it takes too long and your society may not survive long enough to finish that work, then you fall back on government action. And I can't imagine a worse option than government action, because that is almost invariably going to turn oppressive. I mean, there just aren't any good government actions that you can take that don't get dystopian really quick. I mean, you could technically say that, you know, communism, Marxism, whatever, that's a prescribed belief and you can't support it, I suppose, but that's just violates all of our core principles. And that I think is our problem, is trying to find a way of defending our core principles against people who want to weaponize them against us. And having the government try to do that is to destroy the village to save it. That's
in order
not
to save the country right now.
Yeah. That's not, I mean, what you end up with is, you can't save the village by destroying it. What you end up with a country that basically violates your core beliefs. And I honestly don't know how to square that circle. Yeah, sure. For foreigners, if you're an immigrant, we can just send you back home. We have no obligation to keep you here. We can just get rid of you. So basically half of the people that live in Dearborn, Michigan, we could just send them back to Somalia tomorrow. Well, it'd probably take more than a day, but it could be done.
It could be started tomorrow.
It certainly could be started tomorrow. But what do we do with Americans? Because there's no way to do it via the government without imposing repression. And they're perfectly—
That's exactly right.
And they're perfectly willing to use our own principles against us. And that is the circle that is hard to square. How do you tell Americans that is unacceptable? I don't know that you can do it through government, at least not without being super repressive. The only way to get that message through them is through culture.
Yeah, I mean, I'm reminded that no major war has been won unless everybody followed the Queens of Marksbury rules. I mean, when you don't follow those rules, I mean, America is the Revolutionary War is a great example, you know. How did Bill Cosby describe it? Speaking of names who are anathema now, he said, look, we're the Continental Army. We're going to hide behind trees and rocks. We're going to disguise ourselves. We're going to, you know, hop out of all these hidden places and ambush. And then the British, we're going to mark in perfectly straight lines with big red coats on.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't fight an enemy who doesn't agree to the rules of the fight without getting dirty yourself. There's just no way to do it. It's not possible. And there's a reason that wars were won absolutely one way or the other up until the end of World War II, because the rules for engagement were, look, we may not shoot your parachutists out of the sky all the time, but you know, if it comes down to it, fine, we're going to surrender and that's it. Unconditional surrender, boom, it's over. But it's going to take you going a pretty far mile or so to get us to that point to capitulate.
Well, look,
that we had to drop two bombs on Japan.
Look, World War II is
an interesting... I mean, we haven't done that forever.
Yeah, but even in World War II, there's an interesting example to point out at World War II. Oh, by the way, as an aside, one of the best lines ever from Norm Macdonald was his thing with Jerry Seinfeld, Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, where he said, Norm Macdonald was talking to Jerry Seinfeld, and he said, you know, they say that the worst thing about the Bill Cosby thing was the hypocrisy. I don't think that's true at all. Really? What was the worst thing? Well, I always thought the worst thing was the rape. Which, yeah, that's probably a better way to think about it. But going back to World War II, at the end of World War II, the British largely put up statues to and gave extensive honors to all of their major military leaders in World War II. You know, Bill Slim, Bernie Montgomery, all of them. They all got their medals. They all got their lordships and their knighthoods, and they all got statues put up to them, except for one guy that they didn't really want to acknowledge. And that was the head of the RAF Bomber Command, Sir Arthur Harris. Bomber Harris did not get the same level of respect because everyone in Britain knew, and by the way, we probably, if Americans were as, I hesitate to use the word civilized or what have you, but as conscious as the British were of the proper order of things, we probably would have tried to ignore Curtis LeMay as well after World War II, which we did not. But the idea behind was that there was some level of guilt at the fact that, you know, even though the Germans did bomb London, and even though the Germans were horrific and brutal, maybe the firebombing of Dresden was a step too far. You know, there was this guilt about some of the things that were done in World War II, even though I think it could be argued that they were necessary. And by the way, we're going through the same thing in this country and have been for the last 20 years in terms of whether we should have dropped the atomic bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima.
Yeah, that's right. And it disgusts me every time that subject comes up. It's been talked about ad nauseum. Yes, we should have. Period. End of story. It's been debated. Let's not go through it again. It's the dumbest idea in the world that we would have let a war continue on just because maybe some people would die. That's the point of war. People die, things get broken. And you do it until the other side, who attacked us, by the way, says, okay, no mas.
But while that is true in the international sphere, I don't know how you handle that with homegrown progressives who hate
makes it a lot harder.
You know, you can't just start bombing Chicago and New York. Look, we have a very modern, technologically based society where Everything largely works, but everything is done just on time. We have this very complex system that we've created over the past 50 years that if there is a major disruption in American society, millions of people will starve to death.
Well, and we've seen this. We saw it with the pandemic, with the supply line stuff. We saw it with the baby food thing where, you know, a major manufacturer of baby food was shut down, and that caused all kinds of problems. You're absolutely right. I mean, the interconnectedness of economies prevents these sorts of, or at least ameliorates against having opened armed conflict with one another. That was the whole premise of Nixon going to China. You know, there was the whole premise, or even before that, you know, going and opening up China, the open door policy. The idea is that, hey, if we're trading with one another, well, you know, we've got a lot more resources to override beefs, and we can work out a deal somehow. And largely that's true. What happened was that the interconnectedness got controlled by a smaller and smaller cabal of people, and it became politicized.
And the Chinese reverted back to a government run by a modern Chairman Mao, which...
Yeah, you know, all the stuff that What's-His-Face did back in the 80s and the early 90s was lost, absolutely lost.
Yeah, although we're still pursuing that policy, of course, because, well, it's our policy towards China.
Yeah, why would we change it?
Why would we change it? You know, never mind that... Conditions have changed.
Payment.
By the way, I'm noticing we're having streaming issues again this week. So I apologize to everybody in chat for the streaming. This is clearly a YouTube problem, not a me problem. So I'm afraid that you're going to have to deal with it. But we're down to 435 kilobits per second. And I know for a fact that I have much higher upload. So I don't know what's interfering with... what's interfering with us. But in any event,
everybody's podcasting tonight.
Yeah, it must be. The problem, of course, is in the domestic sphere, we simply can't have an armed conflict. There's no way that we could have it without it being so utterly disastrous that, and when I say millions, I'm talking in terms of tens of millions of people would simply die. We wouldn't be able to maintain our systems for feeding ourselves, for providing power, or for anything else. I mean, so that sort of response is closed to us. So what are we left with for fighting these people? And that's what we've been thinking about this. I've been thinking about this for a couple of weeks. I just don't know what the answer is. And some people on the right assume that the answer is, you know, political in some way.
Wow, that's all they've got.
Yeah, and so they just assume that there is some political thing, like the Koch brothers, right? I mean, the Koch brothers have been trying to throw millions of dollars at conservative and libertarian politicians for years. That is not going to bend the arc back towards individual liberty. Because politics is always a rear guard action. The only thing that will work, and it will take a while to work, it seems to me, are creating cultural institutions that can eventually replace the ones that have been infected by progressivism. That seems to me to be the only peaceful way of doing it. I mean, there are things that the government might do at the edges, right? Having some sort of constitutional convention that radically reduces the scope and power of the federal government. I mean, that's something that could possibly be done, but it never will, because 2/3 of our spending are Medicare and Medicaid, or Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid.
Yep. And other transfer payments.
Yeah, too many people depend on that. They're not going to, and anybody who even looks at Social Security cross-eyed and comes up with, well, maybe we should have some sort of means testing for Social Security. That's political death. And so
eventually it's not going to be, because, I mean, people of my generation, you're an honorary member, realize that we're not going to get anything out of that. And it's just going to spend ourselves bankrupt. So stop charging our children. You know, we'll pay whatever. And I think that attitude is pretty well represented throughout our cohort. At least those from, like, you know, the mid-60s through the mid-80s, understand that, look, we're not ever getting at any of that money unless we really need it. So means test. Yeah, absolutely. I have no problems with that. We means test at the beginning, so means test at the end.
Yeah, but
right? You only get charged Medicare up to a certain point of your income. Fine, then that's what you get out of it. And if you go beyond a certain level, well, sorry.
And sure, that sounds good. It's just a political non-starter.
It has been for a long time. I'm thinking that's going to change.
Look,
but either way, that doesn't really answer.
I don't think it's going to change. I think we're going to ride this puppy down in flames.
Until it explodes.
We're going to keep spending and keep spending and keep spending until basically the system collapses. We go into some sort of Brazilian or Argentinian type of hyperinflation, and we'll still maintain the payments of, you know, what is it, $1,600 a month or thereabouts?
Yeah, it'll be green mail.
Yeah, everybody will get their $1,600 a month, with which you can go, you know, buy a cookie,
pack of gum.
A pack of gum. Yeah, exactly. Because it'll be worthless. And we'll just keep shoveling the money out the door at, you know, $1,600 a month per retiree. It'll just be worthless. Basically, Social Security will cease to be anything of any use. And
you know, when it comes to retirement and Social Security and Medicare, how is the way that those programs work any different than how GM was working when it went into its last bankruptcy that we saved them from? They had more retired workers that they were paying for than they had actual workers that they had to pay a salary. And they had to go bankrupt. They had to sell off assets. I mean, that's essentially the shape that our Social Security, our retirement system, funded by the federal government, that's the shape it's in. And it's been known for literally decades that it eventually would come to this. It had to. I mean, the baby boomers outnumber the children they produced and their grandchildren.
Well, in chat, someone said, some Mormon families I know keep a full year's worth of stable food in their cellar. Perhaps more of us need to do that, too. Not a bad idea.
Amen. Amen.
Because what we're heading for is nowhere good. And if you want to spend $5,000 on a can of green beans, we're doing everything we can to get us to that point.
Yeah, absolutely.
And by the way, we've seen this happen in our own hemisphere repeatedly over the past century.
The Weimar Republic.
In Central and South America. But we don't even have to go back to 1920.
That's true.
We can go back to, I don't know, the 1970s, Venezuela. The 1980s. Oh, yeah. The 1990s, we have, in the Western Hemisphere alone, we've seen what happens when governments just...
Zimbabwe went through this almost exact thing.
I mean, Argentina has to issue a new currency every 20 years, for goodness sake.
Right.
Because the old currency is worthless.
Oh, and what's the common denominator with all these places? Oh, that's right. To the extent they didn't describe themselves as socialists, they at least were honest enough to call themselves welfare capitalists.
In the case of Argentina, basically fascists, which basically comes out to another collectivist ideology. All collectivist ideologies lead to disaster.
Absolutely. And they all spring from the same well source, the idea that the Judeo-Christian Western culture concept of an individual as an inviolate political entity is suspect and should be destroyed, that everything should be for the quote-unquote common good, except who gets to decide the common good is never really really discussed terribly well.
Yeah, it's not discussed because we already know the answer is going to be the government. The government gets to right. decide what the common good is, and the government gets to decide what gets spent on it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it was like you were saying, you know, that you know, and the phrase that came to mind to me when you were talking about how we have, what other choice do we have but to look to the government? Far too many people see that as, you know, a perfectly anodyne option.
False choice.
But when you have government, if you have government plus emotion, or power plus emotion, you've just got, you're in a crucible that is going to end in disaster. I mean, it'll take longer some places than others, but if that is the basis of your form of governance is, you know, power and passion, power and emotion, you can't go anywhere good because you cannot respond to what actually needs to be responded to. You certainly can't look down the road as to what needs to be avoided because you have to respond to emotions. Emotions are now. Emotions aren't in the future. Emotions are what we're feeling now. And you can't govern based on what's going on right now. And you have to govern on what is going to come.
Yeah, and yet we are. I mean, we talked about this, I guess, a week or two ago, how Toyota just came out and said, this is electric vehicle mandates are stupid. We can make 15 hybrid vehicles for using the same amount of material it takes to build one electric vehicle. So if you want to solve the problem, yep. hybrid is pretty much, with our current technology, hybrid is the solution. Electric vehicles are not. They're going to be
solution, actually. And
electric vehicles are going to be way too expensive, way too heavy, with nickel cadmium batteries anyway, lithium ion batteries, way too prone to exploding at unpredictable times. There are better answers currently available that get us, this is where the perfect becomes the enemy of the good. Perfect.
Right.
Is believed to be electric vehicles, never mind that we don't have the electric generation capacity for 330 million Americans to recharge their electric vehicles because it's impossible to build a power plant in this country. Never mind the trillions that it would take to build out the infrastructure for all electric vehicles so that we have as many electric vehicle charging stations as we have gas stations. Although
that's where those jobs are going to come from, man. Come on, man.
All those green jobs pursuing a entirely unnecessary solution.
It's a solution to a problem that has been identified and then celebrated by the left for now. Well, I guess it's really the 70s, but really the 80s is when it ramped up. This whole global warming, now it's climate change. It's gone through many iterations. It was global cooling. It was global weirding. There's lots of things. But all to solve this problem that's been created entirely by governments. We don't actually have any physical evidence that any of this stuff is causing harm. Matter of fact, we have a lot of evidence that to the extent, and we know for a fact that we have slightly warmed since the middle of like the 1800s or so.
Yeah, the Little Ice Age, which ended in 1830.
But we haven't, it's been a couple of degrees. It hasn't been anything outstanding. And carbon does not seem to have a hell of a lot to do with it. I understand why it seems like it could, but the evidence does not suggest that. So instead, what we have is the government stepping in saying, well, look, we can fix this problem through force. We'll just not let anybody use this stuff. And then everything will be good and right, and we'll be at the right temperature for the rest of eternity on the planet.
I would just point out that humans contribute about 3% of all the CO2 in the atmosphere. And also that there, we, if it has not happened already while we've been in the podcast, we're about to have what appears to be a major volcanic eruption in Iceland that will, in the next couple of weeks or so, emit more CO2 into the atmosphere than all human activity combined.
Oh, not to mention debris, which will refract light and heat.
Particulate matter, yeah. But once government has decided, and they have in the United States, and look, largely have in Europe as well.
Europe and Australia and Asia.
Electric vehicles.
Well, parts of Asia.
Electric vehicles are the answer. And we'll just all drive our electric cars.
And I wonder how many people realize that electric cars have been around since about the 1910s. And they didn't sell back then in the 20s either, because they were basically useless. They had exactly the same problems you have now.
Range, I don't know if they set on
fire. Yeah, but you couldn't go very far. And you couldn't go all that far in a regular combustion engine either. Back in the 20s, if you got 60, 70 miles out of a few tanks of gas, 2 gallons of gas, that was pretty good. But nobody was worried about that then. They were worried about power. Horsepower was all the rage. Yeah. EVs couldn't produce it, and they sure as hell couldn't last. Not back then. And they still can't. They still have the same problems.
Government is always always setting up the perfect as the enemy of the good.
Always.
And here's the weird thing. In business, we talk about the Pareto principle, right?
Mm-hmm.
20% of your issues, or 20% of your employees, or 20% of your customers, whatever it may be. It's the 80-20 principle, right? 80% of your problems are caused by 20% of the causes. The other 80% contribute 20% to the problem. So just in a normal Pareto analysis, you would think they would say, well, we can get, 80 to, well, and in the specific case, say, of hybrid vehicles, we can probably get 90 to 95% of where we want to be simply by pursuing hybrids.
Yeah, just organically. That will just happen organically.
Right. I mean, your vehicle is basically powered by electrical power. There just happens to be a small generator that generates the electricity to recharge as you drive. It turns on and off as it's needed. And it seems to work fine. Formula One are driving around in 1.6 liter, six cylinder hybrid vehicles at 212 miles an hour down the straight.
Right.
Seems that hybrid...
let's be honest. That's... just like animal husbandry and, bear baiting and all that stuff, a greyhound racing, like all those things were done to test the efficacy of, these particular animals. NASCAR was born out of the idea to test certain engines. F1 was born out of the idea to test performance. All these things are testing grounds. And when you have on the testing grounds these hybrids that can do so much more than your conventionally powered gasoline engines, that's when you start taking a look. It always starts out way more expensive. I remember when microwaves cost $2,500.
Yeah.
And that was on a yearly salary, average salary of around $10,000 to $13,000 a year.
Yeah, it was a good 3 months of income to get a microwave.
Right. and they suck. They're not even as good as the little 1,000 watt ones you get now.
Oh yeah, you can
walk
into
maybe 500-600 watts tops.
You can walk into Walmart, get a 1,000 watt microwave for $50 or $60 at this point.
Right, but it takes somebody doing the expensive work of R&D to get to that point. And that's where rich people actually do us a service, because they're happy to try out these stupid things.
Yeah,
risk their lives and whatever else.
NASA, along with a couple of companies that they're working with, appear to believe that they've come up with a solid state battery that can be recharged to 80% in about 5 to 10 minutes. That has better energy density than lithium ions. That don't explode, because they're, you know, solid state. And that may be the answer to the vehicle side of the problem, getting away from the huge, heavy lithium ion batteries. Okay, great. But it, even if that's true, it doesn't solve the power generation problem. Which is another,
no, it doesn't. That's right.
Which is another order of problem entirely, which is that you can't build a whole bunch of power plants because...
Well, you can't... You're right, because you can't scale both one at a time. You have to scale them at the same time. And if you don't scale up the energy production, then your energy capture system is kind of worthless. I mean, it doesn't make much sense. There's only so much energy out there. It's a finite set of energy. So if you can capture it, keep the vast majority of it. And that's always a problem, latency. I mean, you don't know how much latency there is in a system until you actually test it. By having batteries that are not only cheaper but lighter, you're a long way towards helping improve that problem of storage, but you're nowhere close to solving the problem of
generation
of production. Yeah, I mean, you actually need energy to be produced in order to put into those things. And unfortunately, the only way we know how to do that, well, that's okay, is through these intermittent systems of green energy, the proven sources of petroleum energy, proven source of nuclear energy, but nuclear energy is verboten everywhere but France, apparently.
And by the way, petroleum will eventually be verboten as well. All I guess,
according to a lot of plans, yeah.
I guess all we can hope is that eventually reality will intrude to say, yeah, this plan is not workable. It's not. It can't happen.
And, well, I think it's starting to. I mean, you recall that there were those ethanol rules that the EPA promulgated about how much your gasoline had to be mixed with ethanol.
Yeah, which, by the way, destroys your engine. Just
it kills your gaskets. It screws up all your anything that's rubber within your, and there's a lot of things that are rubber within your engine. It does do that, but they were expecting the industry to simply follow course and say, oh, we need to get it up to this point. Okay, well, then we'll be able to do it. We'll just figure it out. We didn't have any incentive before because, oh, shit, that would have meant like more money in the market. But now the government's forcing us to do it. Oh, wait a minute. No, we don't have the capability of producing that particular blend that you're demanding we do. So we need a reprieve. So as far as I know, that's still on hiatus, simply because it was a goal that was set by the government, couldn't be reached. And Lord help me, it just reminds me of how the Soviet Union dealt with things in their five-year plans. Well, I don't care how much bread you think you can produce. This is how much you have to
produce. This is the quota, and you'll produce it or you'll end up in Siberia, comrade.
So, and, I mean, and you're so, gonna get a lot of straw stuffed in that bread, but
yeah. And so, you know, what you end up with in a system like that, and it's we saw it in the Soviet Union, which is if my factory's quota is 500,000 pairs of shoes, then the easiest way to meet that quota and to conserve materials is just to produce 500,000 pairs of size 5.
Exactly. And I don't have to change any machines. I don't have to do anything.
Yeah, I don't have to change any jigs or dies or cutters. I just come out with 500,000 size 5s. And if you're not size 5, well, I guess you'll do without shoes. But we met our quota. And government interference almost always ends up that way. There's this fantasy that these people in government are so smart and so competent, yep, And by the way, it goes back hundreds or decades.
So unbiased.
It goes back 100 years. It goes all the way back to the progressive movement of the late 19th and early 20th century, where you ended up with Woodrow Wilson, who thought, if only I had dictatorial power, and I could have.
If only we were on four footing all the time.
And I could, and all the smart people would work for government, and smart people would figure all this out, and we could have our 5-year plans, and everything would work. And it just completely ignores the fact that you don't have enough information, and you can't possibly have enough information to make a centralized system like that work. And increasingly,
yeah, that was one of the major themes of Road to Serfdom.
Yeah, and we are increasingly trusting the government with this sort of childlike naivete that, oh, well, the government can fix all this. No, the government is almost always the problem. There are certain things that the government does and does relatively well. If you need foreigners killed, government is your go-to agency for killing foreigners. Anything that you need to do inside the national economy, government cannot possibly.
I mean, the best you can do is
fix that out.
They can pass laws and enforce some of them, and that's the best they can do.
Yeah, and of course, whenever they do pass those laws, they will almost always pass the wrong laws or have them implemented in the wrong way.
Right.
I don't know. We got a long way to go before we crawl out of this hole that we've gotten ourselves into. But we're not going to crawl out of it tonight, although we are going to crawl out of this podcast, I guess. So, Michael, as always, thanks for being here. We'll look forward to talking to you again soon.
All right,
bye. You've been watching or listening to, if you're listening to the audio version, of the Observations Podcast for Sunday, the 12th of November, 2023. Thanks for joining us on the podcast. Hope you'll be with us again next time. Until then, have a great week. So long.